There we go. I call this meeting of the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order. We haven't been here for a while, so Paul and I are sharing responsibilities today. So we're going to go back and forth through the agenda as we hear from the Department of Agriculture, the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, and the Ag Utilization Research Institute. So to get back in the swing of things, I would note that a quorum is present, and we need a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Gottfried, have you reviewed the minutes?
I have, and I motion to move the minutes.
Representative Gottfried moves the minutes. Are there any questions? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Unanimous, the minutes are adopted. Next, we will move into the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we welcome Commissioner Tom Peterson. Oh, Paul has comments, but you can come up. Chair Anderson.
Everybody, welcome back to the Ag Committee. Good to be here. First day of session, we've been advised to read some ground rules. We trust the Ag Committee will be its usual nonpartisan, well-behaved committee, but anyway, we're supposed to read these notices to all of you. Welcome to the House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout the hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. I, Chair Anderson, along with Chair Hansen, maintain control of all these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is also prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak with our sergeant staff, the folks with the gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everybody's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits and must be strictly adhered to. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain that ticket as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. And failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone with the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. Thanks for your cooperation and participation in this session's legislative process. And again, welcome all of you. Now back to Chair Hansen.
And Chair Anderson, I believe that ticket that they receive is only good for today. They will get, if people come to the next hearing, there will be another ticket.
Unless there's a gold ticket for Commissioner.
Commissioner Peterson, welcome to the committee. And Commissioner Vobel, welcome as well. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair and members. Tom Peterson, Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Good afternoon. Andrea Vobel, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Agriculture.
And we're going to walk through our slides today. I just wanted to start by just also saying we have Commissioner Bailey here and Commissioner Chesset, our division directors, Michelle Medina, our legislative director, and we also a new addition to our staff is our tribal liaison, Cindy Bergloff, who works with our tribal nations, joined us after our last tribal liaison went on to a new position. And, you know, and I try to, just as a reminder, bring, you know, relevant staff to committees. I think it's worth your time. So we'll try to walk through these slides. And if we have really technical questions, we have really great people that can answer all of those questions. So just real quick, I just want to go through a couple of things. Just a reminder on the Minnesota's ag industry, 65,000 farms. And unfortunately, we kind of have breaking news today that our farm numbers declined to 64,000 in the past year. We're still kind of digging into those numbers. We had no change last year, but some of that may have been with the administration change it was kind of interesting that the number was the same, and NAS, which is the National Ag Statistics Service, had, you know, staff cutbacks. In fact, the office in Minnesota is not here anymore. So we're kind of digging into those numbers, but, you know, I do hope that it's not an indicator of what kind of we're seeing out in the countryside and other things. And there's more we could say on that. And then, and just remember what constitutes a farm is $1,000 with a gross income a year. So, really interesting when you look at the whole scope of agriculture in Minnesota. And then you can see the sectors that we have. And then again, we have 500 employees. Most of you are familiar with what we do with promoting farm products, diseases, pests, grocery stores, and regulating feed mills and fertilizer. Our two main areas of responsibility, promoting our food supply and protecting our state's natural resources and supporting, promoting agriculture. You can see our main divisions here. And I'm not going to read them all, but I think we have all our division directors here today. So, great to have them here today. Just a reminder, we're actually using our 24-25 base budget numbers because we're still in the middle of our 26-27, budget. And just a reminder of where, I think this is more of our expenditures of where we, spend our money. You can see most of it is in protection services. Those are the blue things, pesticide, fertilizer, plant protection, lab, and then our marketing. You can see that is about 33% of our budget, and then admin is about 14%. And then similar on the this is actually more on the funding side, and I think this is relevant in a minute. You know, general funds about 38%, dedicated funds from fees and everything is 35%. Legacy, you know, has always been a more stable piece of that, stays in, you know, they all stay in about that range the last few years, nothing major changing in that. Federal funds are about 13% of our total budget. And going into the next thing, with the 13% of the federal funds, one issue I wanted to address is January 9th, the governor received a letter from the president. It was actually to Governor Walz and Mayor Fry, essentially suspending active and future awards to MDA. And so that's 13% of our budget. That's a lot of really important issues. You know, and there wasn't a lot of detail with that or follow-up. It was really hard to get a hold of somebody. We had a lot of farmers asking, was that our bridge payments? Was that our DMC? Our immediate concern was for HPAI or active awards within that. And you can see where our grants come from within the U.S. Within the USDA, there's several big pieces. So AMS, Ag Marketing Services, APHIS, which works with the plant and animals, FSIS, which is our food safety inspection, FDA, EPA, but also like Forest Service, we do spongy moth, things like that. So we were told grants, cooperative agreements, you know, were suspended till further notice. And so pending justification and review. And that became a problem about a few days later with the Wilmer Poultry Lab when we were notified that the lab wouldn't be doing testing, we wouldn't be reimbursed for that. And we also did have an active HPAI case at that time. Worked with the Board of Animal Health, with the University of Minnesota, with our congressional delegation, both parties, to clarify that that was not included in that. And so that was kind of interesting. But just so everybody knows, I think that we appreciated the work of our congressional delegation. I always had good, able to reach the secretary staff and have a good relationship with them. So we were able to clarify that those were open. But as we kind of went into it, we never got any really further guidance. Then we did get a list of programs that were, you know, submitted to us. Those were some really important pieces for us. But I was able to, Deputy Commissioner and I went to D.C. 2 weeks ago, and we were able to visit with a lot of the USDA staff and leadership. In fact, I met with the Secretary's Chief of Staff, and again, they assured us that we have good programs. The Department of Ag has a good track record, and they will continue to pay and until further notice. And so so far nothing has been frozen. Things are processing, but we haven't gotten an all clear yet either. You know, so if you have questions about that, but just know we're working on that. And again, we've had good, you know, support, especially from Senator Klobuchar, Representative Craig, and Representative Finstad and Representative Fishbach's office on that. So hopefully that goes forward. Go ahead.
We were asked to just touch on our anti-fraud efforts at the agency. So just a couple of things we wanted to cover. One thing is, again, for us, any taxpayer dollars that goes to fraud, waste, or abuse is a magnificent problem and one we take personally. So a couple of things we do at the agency. One is a culture of shared responsibility. So we have a lot of conversations and talk with staff about the importance of all of us being vigilant and making sure that every dollar is where it's supposed to go. We also have been very communicative around our reporting process. So it's very outlined how staff can report whether or not they suspect any fraud, waste, or abuse. They can talk to their supervisor. They can talk to our legal compliance folks. They can talk to the commissioner himself, whomever they feel most comfortable talking to report what they see, and then we can follow up on that. We do have a seat. Governor Walz created the Office of the Inspector General Coordinating Council, or OIGCC, as part of his recent executive order. We have a seat on that and have been actively part of those conversations on an enterprise level on ways that we can improve particularly grant-making processes throughout the enterprise. We've gotten a lot of great feedback on, you know, how we can help with things that we're doing at our agency and lessons learned from other agencies. We have, in the last year or two, hired two new positions. So we have a compliance coordinator. We actually introduced Fakata. His name is last year. So he is now in charge of just making sure that all of our internal controls are as they should be. He'll do internal audits, looking at programs that we ask him to look at to just make sure we're doing what we should be doing. We welcome any and all audits. We see them as a way to improve and help make sure that we're doing what we need to be doing or finding ways that we can improve processes that we've built. We also hired a grants administrator for the first time for the agency. So this person is in charge of making sure that everything we're doing in terms of grants across divisions is aligned and matched. So we've grown quite a bit in terms of the grants that we have at the agency. We started with one of our divisions mostly, and it spread to others. So we want to make sure that we're aligned and consistent in how we're administering our grants. We also do a lot of work with our review committee. So we have Minnesotans, many of them are in this room, who have served on review committees. So it's not necessarily ag staff that are looking and deciding who gets these grants. We really rely on a lot of folks from stakeholders, members of the public, anybody interested that we can get involved to look at these grants for us and make recommendations. Ultimately, the commissioner decides, he very heavily relies on the recommendations from the review committee. We also do a number of site visits. We actually do site visits more than required by OGM requirements. So they ask that we look at projects with $50,000 or more. We look at ones that are $25,000 or more. So we make the extra effort just to make sure that the dollars are being spent the way that that it should. We definitely have a feeling of a continuous improvement. There's always ways that we're finding that we can improve our internal controls. We can improve our processes. We can learn from other agencies. We make it a practice to look at audits from other agencies that the Legislative Audit Commission looks at to see if there's anything that best practices that we could absorb at our agency. So we really try to make sure that there's any gaps that we're seeing that we're fixing immediately. We also have seen an uptake of fraudulent applications that have come into our agency, and our staff worked really diligently to identify those very quickly and come up with best practices to help and share with other division staff about what they should be looking for. The nice thing is, you know, we've got folks who really understand who the folks we serve and could see where things were maybe just a little bit fishy. So that's been another way we've continuously improved our processes over time. We have had a couple of audits over the last couple of years. We are close to having our Ag Water Quality Certification Program audit come out, I think any time now. And then we also have one currently for our Elk Compensation Program. Like I said before, we welcome audits. Nobody likes to be audited, but we really value the sort of extra set of eyes to make sure that we're doing what we need to be doing and if there's anything that we're missing. So again, we take it extremely seriously. It's something we're thinking about all the time and ways that we can make sure that the money's going where it should be going.
Then just jumping into some of the issues of interest to the committee, the first one we're going to address is a Dairy with an Eye program, we call it. I think it was $3 million was appropriated in 2024. And, you know, to kind of cut to the chase, we actually have the sign up open right now. About mid-January, the USDA opened the new DMC, or Dairy Margin Program, for the dairy farmers. And then our program helps them as an incentive to get into that program. And again, we had this program in 2019, and Minnesota led the nation in sign up. So it's a really good program. Again, it's open until March 19th. The one piece that we're looking at is the way we set up the bill a couple years ago was based on production numbers till 2022. And I understand you'll have a bill that a department would support to catch some of those farmers that started in 23, 24, and 25. I estimate that to be somewhere between 30 and 40 farms total. There's 70, but some are partnerships and just continuing on. But appreciate the work on that. Minnesota currently has about 1,560 dairy farms.
Okay, farm to food security. So this is a new name for a program that you'll recognize. So thanks to Representative Lee and this committee, established in 2025 as the Local Food Purchasing Assistance Program, or LFPA. You'll recall there was a large award we received from the federal government that was cut. And so you all kindly created a state level program. And I will say that's nation leading. We've got a lot of our sister states that are very jealous that we were able to get this on a state level. So this one is to support local farmers and producers by funding projects to purchase Minnesota-grown and raised food and distribute it to Minnesotans experiencing food security. We did name it Farm to Food Security. We just want to make sure we just avoid any confusion with the requirements as part of the federal grant program and really just kind of differentiate from anything happening with the federal level. This is really a Minnesota-led and created and designed program. So you all allocated $700,000 each year of the biennium, and the request for proposals for that will be released very soon, maybe tomorrow. So coming soon. Our down payment assistance grant, many of you will remember this. So it established in 2023. We received $1.25 million in fiscal year 26 as well as 27, and then $1 million in fiscal year 28 and thereafter. You will maybe recall when it was first established, we were doing $15,000 grants for first-time farm buyers. You just increased that to $20,000 last year. How we administer that is a lottery application with priority for farmers who earn less than $100,000 in gross farm sales and or grow cannabis, industrial hemp, or specialty crops. And grain and livestock farms can meet the priority if their gross sales are less than $100,000. Combined for fiscal year 23 through 25, we've supported 112 farmers in buying their first piece of land. We have an additional 17 awards so far in fiscal year 26 that are closed or closing as scheduled, and we have a remaining 45 awards pending purchase agreements. This is, again, that we a new program, so we're always constantly figuring out ways that we can improve and change the processes. So you'll see we've made a couple of updates since it began in 2023, and we suspect we'll have more over time. But, of course, we're always learning and open to ideas, so if you hear of anything from your constituents that would help make this work better, we are all ears.
Commissioner Vabo, just a quick question on the program. You say it's a lottery application. Is there any priority given to somebody who has a purchase agreement in hand compared to somebody who is just looking yet?
Commissioner Vabo.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and Representative Chair Anderson. So at this time, we do not have that, but that is a conversation we're having about a possibility just to make sure that the money is going to folks that are most ready. But that is something that we're considering as part of an option.
And Commissioner, as follow-up, are you losing people who may not seal the deal in 6 months? Is there a problem there where they may apply and they can't get the closing done in time? Is that an issue?
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Yes. So it's an issue in that we do allow 6 months. Folks can ask for more time. So that's something they can do, and we've provided that if they need more time. However, we are running into situations where the money, the deal falls through and the money is unable to be spent. So we end up in a little bit of a pickle because the money is then not available again to respend because it's too late. So that's one thing we're also working on is some way that we can help figure out how to get that money into the folks that are most ready so it's spent in a timely manner.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. And this is just a breakdown. We do have a legislative report that's very thorough. So if you have any questions, we're happy to send that over to you. But this does have a farm location map here. So you'll see where a number of the DPA grants have gone regionally. And then you'll see the breakdown in the pie chart. 42% of the awardees are grain or row crop farmers. 31% are specialty crop. We've had 25% of cannabis or hemp, and then 27% have gone to livestock producers.
Okay. And now moving on with the grain indemnity count update there. If you recall, the count was funded with $10 million from the general fund in 2024. And there's about $10.7 million in the account currently due to accrued interest. We do have our first claim on the account that many of you may be familiar with, and that was a failure of a Hanson Mueller, which has a licensed facility in Duluth in the port there, as well as one in Superior, Wisconsin, Grand Forks, North Dakota. We, to date, have received 19 claims for a total of $1.1 million. $842,000 of those transactions are in Minnesota. A lot of those are oats, too, that I'd met. So just wanted to remind folks, too, that the fee would not turn into $8 million as well. And then here's just kind of a quick line, because we get a lot of questions from the farmers, like how soon, you know, would this work and everything. And so as we're working and processing this, just on some of the other failures that we've had, we're only 90 days into the Hanson Mueller. These are complex cases with a lot of moving pieces, and you can see how long some of the other cases took recently. We are working with the National Association of Attorney Generals, which is called NAG, and to, I don't know, I got to workshop that, but with a take the, to get information from the Compel the company to get us information. We're having a hard time getting some of that. And so that's a really important piece. And then the next slide is just a how it's worked. The claim is submitted by a farmer, and then we verify that, and the claim is validated using information. And if the claim is valid, the claim payment is initiated. And then you can see that we have tax info and that kind of piece. And then the other important piece as we're working through right now is MDA will file a claim with the bankruptcy court to recoup costs to the indemnity count. And then that money, if that is recouped, and hopefully it will, there is some grain there, would go back into the indemnity account. And so, you know, it's unknown, you know, at this point, but there is some grain there.
And I should note, Commissioner, that there is no relation between the co-chair. And
that's right. Okay, that's good to know. You know, I was going to ask, but no. Next, another
just
really.
Just a second. Just a second.
Yeah.
Commissioner Peterson, yep. Explain the two different numbers: 1.1 million and 842,000. Why the discrepancy?
Commissioner Peterson,
what slide are we looking at here?
Page 13.
Oh, page 13. Yep, 1.1 is what, so some of those transactions were made of Minnesota farmers sold in North Dakota and or Wisconsin. We have one in Wisconsin and a couple in North Dakota. So our indemnity count, the way I read it, and our interpretation is the indemnity count covers grain sold in Minnesota. And so we're working with North Dakota and Wisconsin to with those Minnesota farmers. They also have indemnity accounts. You know, and so that was that number. So we know of 1.1 million in transactions, but 842 of those were specifically in Minnesota, if that helps.
Does Wisconsin have a program? I had heard they did not.
Yeah, I don't think they actually, or it doesn't qualify. Is that right? They don't. I thought they did, but they don't. Oh,
Commissioner.
The facility was not licensed in Wisconsin, so that's a whole separate issue. So we can get you more information on that. So, okay,
proceed.
On to my, what's that? Okay,
proceed.
My next favorite issue: elk damage to crops and fences. In this is up in Representative Burkle's district. As we said, a lot of stuff up in Representative Burkle's district. So. They, you know, and you know, I think you all are familiar with this. If you've been on the committee for a while, you can see that we've just continued to have quite a bit of elk damage, and you can see the claims submitted in 2026. We can go to the next slide just to kind of dig into the numbers. And we did increase the appropriation last year, and so that was helpful. But we continue to, you know, see an increase in that. The problem is, you can see there, where we've already paid $217,000 from the 25 backlog, which left us $37,000 available for 26. We've already had $76,000 available in claims submitted to date. So we're projecting $138,000 shortfall in 26 and $83,000 in fiscal year 27. And again, I, you know, as we get into the audit and we look at recommendations and things, I think that'll be important in that. And keep in mind, remember, for the committee members, that we also have a WOLF fund. And you also, the committee has given us the, in the legislature, the ability to transfer money on years from the ELK fund to the WOLF fund, because some years the ELK fund is more, the WOLF fund is more, and we've always had that. Our problem right now is they're both, like, just really, deficient in money. And so you can see the WOLF slide there, and you can see the claims that we've had in 24, 25, and 26. And we're just now getting into spring calving season. We're already running a deficit. The, piece there, too, of cattle prices are pretty high, and we've just had a strong piece. There is some developments happening at the federal level as we see potentially a delisting, and so we'll see what happens. But we also are working on a federal grant. We haven't received that for the last 2 years, and, you know, we're kind of working on that, too, to see that we sometimes are able to catch up our depredation, but also do our non-lethal, which helps keeps our claim downs, too, as well. But you can see that $210,000 anticipated shortfall in 26 and $230,000 in 27. And what we do is we pay what we can, and then we kick it into the next year. So right now, when farmers call me and send me a picture at 6 in the morning of a dead calf, I have to tell them that, you know, it's going to be a while before you get paid, or at least July. So that is that. Next, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we have Dr. Hafes here, and he's going to present. I know, or is he presenting here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And because he's not in the Senate, I think. So anyways, just a big issue, and I will let him address this. I really appreciate the partnership we have with the Board of Animal Health, working very closely with our Office of Emergency Preparedness. The thing I want to highlight for the committee is the balance in the in the Agriculture Response Fund, about $2.5 million. And we're also waiting for some reimbursement there, too, as well, from the federal government. So, you know, it's hard to say if we're in good shape there or not. I feel comfortable. I sleep at night with that amount. I feel like we manage it really well. And I appreciate the support we've had for the committee in the past. You can go to the next one. I would say, too, here's just a place of where we've had on the right is We did have it in 24 in dairy farms, and then we had nothing in, well, we had a weird case in one dairy farm last year. But you can see where our dairy and poultry farms are located. So as we get, you know, everybody saw swans on Sunday, coming back. And that is one thing that, you know, stresses me out a little bit, because as we get into the bird migration, you know, we hope that they're not bringing HPAI back in with us. But that's just kind of a spot where you can see all that. And I'll turn it back over to you.
We just wanted to talk a little bit about our Rural Finance Authority. So the RFA, as we call it, is the state ag lender with a mission to develop farm resources. So we offer low interest loan programs for a variety of farm activities. And you'll see a list there, land purchases, farm improvements, equipment, meat and poultry processing, et cetera, et cetera. So how that works is we participate with local lenders who lend all the money, and then we buy back for 45% of the loan. The borrower pays the lender, and then the lender pays us. This has been around since the 1980s. Many of you are familiar with it and have supported it thoroughly in the past. It is funded in part by sale of state bonds, which the RFA must pay back. It is housed out of the Department of Agriculture, but we have a fantastic board who we meet with and help guide the funding and decisions need to be made for RFA purposes. We just want to highlight that we do have a bonding request that we'll be discussing in committee. But in the governor's proposal, there's $50 million for RFA in the for the 2026 bonding bill. We received a $50 million appropriation in 2023, thanks to this body. The grants covered under that are beginning farmer and seller assisted, that's tax exempt or taxable, ag improvement, and a livestock expansion, as well as our restructure loan. We have about $26 million left of that authorization, but loan requests have increased significantly due to the high interest rate environment and obviously the low interest rate that we offer through the RFA, so there's a lot of interest in those loans. We expect to exhaust funds by around July of 2027, but I will say that that varies. That can change pretty significantly pretty quickly. So right now it could be July, it could be August, September, October, November,
or earlier.
So we keep a close eye on it to make sure that we can keep you apprised of where we're at. But that's why we're coming to you this year for the $50 million to make sure there's no gap. We're also very proud of the performance measures for RFA. Again, it started in 1986 through today. We've got 3,951 loans issued, totaling around $390.3 million. We've taken some losses on 24 loans, so that's a 0.0017% of total dollar default. And we currently have 1,008 active loans with a balance of over $139 million. So it's a very successful program and goes a long way. We're also incredibly proud of our East Grand Forks potato facility in Representative Gander's district. Thank you so much for your steadfast support on this. And I know working with Representative Burkle with our potato growers. So this is a building that we've had since 1993, and it supports an over $240 million industry. So it is in East Grand Forks. We do need significant upgrades to this building. It is the only building that we own as a department. It's incredibly important. It's a wonderful hub for potato growers in that area because we share a parking lot with USDA AMS as well as the Northland Potato Growers. So it's really optimally put there and a welcome part of the community. So we are... you know, we have our East Grand Forks program budget, so you'll see 65,000 of that goes to the pest surveys we perform, 489 goes to seed potato certification, we get a general fund appropriation of 240,000, and then our potato inspections fund the 132,000. So we do have a request in the bonding bill for $1.38 million for building improvements and maintenance. And here's a list of the things that we just need to make sure to update. Like I said, it's been around since 1993. We've had to defer a number of maintenance projects over time. You have given us funding in the past in previous bonding bills through geo bonds and cash. And most of that went to cover the roof that we needed upgraded. And as you can imagine, over time, the materials increased significantly from when we first thought we would be doing some of these upgrades. So we are coming to the bonding committee for additional funding for our East Grand Forks potato facility. And with that, we're happy to stand for questions.
So we've set aside about 10 minutes for questions. Representative Bang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, and good to see you guys again. I have a question relating to recent activity with ICE. I understand that with the Operation Metro Surge, our urban core has been largely impacted, but curious to see if you've heard anything affecting the ag industry or in greater Minnesota.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bang, you know, first of all, I'll just say, things have gotten much quieter this week, and so I really appreciate that. But I would say the last month has been extremely difficult. I would say, you know, my personal thought is we did not see, visits to farms right away. We did, though, in the last couple of weeks before we had the drawdown or the initial drawdown, and we started to see, visits to farms. And I think what was really hard for farmers was that, you know, these folks that were detained or were questioned and everything else were here with H-2A visas or proper documentation. And so it was very upsetting. I think the other part was we saw ICE just not go into farms, but park outside of farms. And so, I'd have a farmer call me and say, what do I do? What are my rights? Whether it was Stearns County or Western Minnesota, a lot of activity got put into the Twin Cities. I think that was concerning. I think we also saw some of our bigger plants visited and, you know, workers detained. And so that was concerning. We relayed those, you know, concerns to the governor's office, to our congressional delegation. And then, as you know or you're familiar, a lot of our immigrant farmers may live in the Twin Cities area and were, impacted by that too. And so Then you would go into like food businesses in rural Minnesota where we have like high cultural village places where I visited last week, whether or last couple of weeks, whether that's Wilmer, Owatonna, Austin, where you may have a market that was closed. And so some of our food co-ops where farmers may sell locally, farmers lost a couple of weeks of sales. Food co-ops, some of those cultural grocery stores lost quite a bit of dollars, and so hopefully we have a couple other processing plants that also had to shut down. A couple of our larger plants had to maybe cut down a third shift. And so, continuing, hopefully we can grow out of that. And I think that, things have really quieted down the last week, and I hope it continues that way.
Representative Vang? Representative Gander?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you both very much for the work that you've done up in East Grand Forks. The timing couldn't be better. I know you're fully aware of the investment of $450 million by Agristo for potato processing on the Grand Forks side. So we're going to see a growth in potato acreage across our side and the Grand Forks side. It's going to be great for producers to not have to go too far with their product, for processing. And I look forward to you guys staying engaged even as we try to add those acres. And what does that look like in coordinating all the inspection, all the seed, all the other inputs that have to go into that farm economy for the potatoes to happen? So I want to thank you for making the trip up there, supporting this. I'm sure you supported it to the governor also. Anything else you want to add on the whole Agristo thing would be just great. Thank you.
Commissioner. Yeah, real quick, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Gander, it's not every day I write a letter of support for a facility being located in Wisconsin, but they're actually looking at North Dakota. They're actually looking at southern Wisconsin, but where we look at where our potato industry is, and if you look at, East Grand Forks, there's kind of a potato alley with warehouses, with like mayo manufacturing, all these different businesses that will gain by having thousands of acres of potatoes in the valley there. So that is going to be a tremendous economic activity for the area. And so appreciate your work on that.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate also all the work we're going to be doing moving forward on this potato policy. But I got a question related more to the pass-through grants that changed to competitive grants. I've had some questions back home about the program, how it was rolled out. Could you just kind of give us a quick synopsis of how things look and how the program's working?
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Burkle, that's a great question. We made a significant change last year in the legislature, and not, just the Ag Committee, but a lot of the pass-through grants that we've had over the years that we've had for many years. We created a program called AgriWorks. So instead of having, I think we had maybe 10 pass-through grants, they had to become competitive. And, and so that's what we did. The one decision that I made in working with staff was, even though the appropriations for 2 years, we split it out into a year and a year, because I wanted to kind of see how the process went and how it, what happened. In case you all would like to make some changes to it or anything as you based on it, I'm open to that. So we had the first round. It opened last year. We've made awards. We haven't made them public yet because we're still signing contracts. And, I think the process went really well. Again, we used a staff review, a review committee of outside folks, as Deputy Commissioner Vobel said. I would just say, I can't comment totally, but many of the same folks got awards, but we also were able to do some new groups that got awards. One thing I'd also say that some of our grantees are going to see with some of the changes in MMB and some of the changes with legislature is just there's some more reporting requirements for grants. And so some of the people are kind of like they've always had the same old, here's your money, here's your due. But, we are asking a little bit more of them, and I think that's a good idea. So as we get into that, those will be made public here at some point as contracts are all signed. And but again, open to looking at suggestions if there's things that we'd want to do with that.
Representative Burkle. Representative Smith, and then Representative Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I wanted to return to something Representative Vang was asking about with the increased activity of federal agencies against our immigrant population here in Minnesota, including legal immigrants. There's a great story this week in the Strib about legal immigrants, potentially hired farmhands who would normally come to a variety of facilities here in Minnesota across the agricultural spectrum, not wanting to come to our state because of the unconstitutional actions we've seen and have been targeted by the federal administration. I just want to ask an open-ended question of your department, how you, if you share those fears and what you think we might be looking at as we head towards planting and ultimate harvest season where more of these sort of workers are going to be necessary for our farms.
Commissioner.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, again, I'm concerned about it. You know, before this all happened, we had a workforce program a problem within agriculture. We're short workers, you know, and so you can talk to any farmer that's going to hire, labor in the spring. You know, part of what we do in the Department of Agriculture is also nursery and landscaping. You know, and, those folks, many of them have a lot of H-2A workers, they hire a lot of seasonal workers. They're, the issue is some of those workers, there's plenty of work in other states. You know, there's a lot of people who wanted to come to Minnesota, and there's a concern. I'm going to go to Michigan, we're going to go to California instead of Minnesota, we're going to South Dakota. And so that is, reassuring folks with that, because we also, we have large fruit and vegetable growers that they're going to be in the greenhouses maybe next week, you know, as they start planting that, and they have workers that come now, and they have seen, you know, a decrease in workers and are scrambling to kind of fill those positions. So, again, I hope that the activities of last week send a signal that it's, and that's something we're reassuring. It's not, under my purview or anything, but as, promoter and trying to work with agriculture, we're working to reassure folks that that is, something that, we need to address. But also our plants, around the state. And like I said, this all happened, in January, we're fortunate that it didn't happen in May, when we're in a heavy planting season or something like that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I absolutely share those fears and would love continued conversation on this committee on how we can potentially help those farms. Another just follow-up question, a clarifying question on specifically the avian flu testing that we're engaged in. There was a brief period we were concerned when we didn't know what exactly a federal funding freeze might mean, that resources specifically around testing as we come towards spring, again, a time where we need this quite urgently, that there was going to be some delays. Have there been any delays? Has that smoothed? Does the department feel like we're ready for spring where we get a lot of or have a high need for testing around avian influenza?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, thank you for that question because it's a really important question. We really don't know, but I feel like Minnesota is really prepared. You know, unfortunately, being number one in turkeys in the state and having, been number one in cases just because of our population of birds and our blessing of having 10,000 lakes and water that the birds like, we've had a lot of cases, but we're also very prepared. We also, to me, we have a pretty well-oiled machine, whether we're working with the USDA, the Board of Animal Health, our grower associations, our companies, we're able to, University of Minnesota. You know, University of Minnesota, one thing the administration did too was award almost $1 million in 5 grants in research for HPAI here in the last year and to one of our grower associations too. So I do feel like we're really prepared, and so far nothing has been impacted by that. But, for about a day, we were really worried.
Co-Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Chair Hansen. A question for Deputy Commissioner Wobble, and I told her I was going to ask this, so this is not a gotcha question, but we passed legislation last year, kind of a unique bio-incentive program to reduce the use of fertilizer, and haven't heard much about it. I've called down a couple of times. Farmers are contacting me, and the last I heard from somebody in the department was there's going to be a website up and running by January. I haven't seen it yet, and the program would be rolled out by March, which is about a couple weeks away. And spring is close, so give me a status report on the that bio-incentive program.
Commissioner Vobel.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and Chair Anderson. Yes, so that will be open. We just double checked with staff this morning, March. So we'll have that open until August. We can't say too much more about what it'll be because it'll be an RFP, a competitive process. But you have my word that it will be out by March.
That's probably just, a farmer
I'm just waiting for the phone to go off. Yeah. Co-Chair Anderson, and then I have a quick comment, but follow-up?
No, thank you for that update. You know, applying for the program in August after planting in whatever, March or April, a little bit late, but again, first year, I appreciate the work on it, and I do think there's interest in it. Mm-hmm. Is a way to reduce the use of fertilizer in a proactive way by farmers, so thanks for getting on that. Thank you.
Commissioners, thank you for being here. I do have one request. If you could work with our nonpartisan staff to maybe identify any unencumbered funds from prior appropriations or any cancellations of funds that may have that will not be used. If that would be something we could get back to the committee, that would be great.
You do that.
With that, I hand the gavel over to Chair Anderson.
Next up. Dr. Hafes, go ahead.
All right, thank you. My name is Dr. Brian Hafes. I'm the Minnesota State Veterinarian and Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Do you want to introduce yourself?
And hi, everyone. I'm Michelle Medina. I serve as Director of Government Relations for the Department of Ag and the Board of Animal Health.
Just a quick overview of kind of the differences with my agency. So this is a state agency that isn't overseen by a commissioner. We are advised by a board of directors or board members that are appointed by the governor. So seven members, including four livestock producers and three veterinarians. One of those veterinarians is a companion animal veterinarian, and one of our livestock producers is a member of a tribal nation, recognized tribal nation. Emergency priorities. So these are just kind of bullet points on some activities that have kept us busy this year. I'll go through them individually, but topping the list obviously is our high path avian influenza. Avian metapneumovirus still is circulating in our poultry industry. New World screwworm has taken a step up the list for us. And then we have a couple of equine viruses that caused us a little extra activity this year. And then I will talk some more about companion animal diseases. High path avian influenza. So this is our current picture. This is just identifying the cases we had in the last year, basically. 35 cases total, 27 of those were commercial premises, both turkey and chickens, and then eight backyard premises. Genomic sequencing has been showing that the current infections are from wild birds. So we get a lot of information from our partners up north, Alaska and Canada, are great on letting us know what's migrating south. And then this time of year, we get great information from our southern neighbors about what's migrating north. So I guess the point of that is the subtype we're seeing is the D1.1. That's what's circulating in wild birds to identify the difference between previous years where we had the B3.13, which we called the dairy strain. So none of the infections that we are seeing now are coming from cross-contamination from other species. This is a direct contamination from wild birds migrating through. So we are still detecting virus in Minnesota flocks. Currently, I shouldn't say this out loud, but we have, I shouldn't say it, but I'm going to. We had four cases this year so far, which is a low number. So we are actually working with just one active control area. That's a good thing. That means we are getting this virus taken care of and cleaned up off the landscape in a hurry. But we are just on the cusp of migratory season, and we know March is kind of when when we expect those cases to come back with a vengeance. I think I said that last year, and we ended up with just two or three cases last spring. So that was a nice reprieve. Certainly came back with a little more of a vengeance in the fall. I think the point that we're realizing is this is, we tie it to migratory birds, but ultimately it is endemic now. So that would suggest, or what I'm saying is it's in some of our other bird species in the area. We see it throughout the winter in raptors. We're starting to see it in other birds that we didn't expect before. I think recently actually crows have been detecting virus as well. So a lot of changes. We continue to partner with industry and academia just to research this more. Where is this virus going? How is it mutating? How is it spreading to other species? And response fatigue. I think I talked about this last year. So we are entering our fourth consecutive year of this. So we have waxing and waning of this virus, but ultimately March is going to be the fourth consecutive year that we have been dealing with this. The previous outbreak we had was in 2015, and that was a real intense period for about 3 or 4 months, and then the virus was kind of gone. We didn't have to deal with it for about 7 years, but that has not been the case, which is kind of my point. This is an endemic virus now. We still treat it as a foreign animal disease based on our response and our federal partners' response, but for all intents and purposes, we consider this just to be in the environment, in the area. So the fatigue is real for our veterinarians, certainly for our producers. This is something that just adds additional stress to the production of our poultry species. And what are we doing about it? So there's been a lot more activity around response actions that are different from what we've been doing. There was a USDA grant that was offered, and I think actually Commissioner Peterson was referring to this, the Highly Pathogenic Avian Influenza Grand Challenge, which was awarding different applicants funds to do more research on things like vaccine, on how we're responding to it, how we're dealing with biosecurity and those kinds of things. And Minnesota showed up for that. We ended up with six awards in Minnesota, five through the university and an additional award through industry. But of those awards, vaccine research is part of it. So this has been a big discussion. We've talked about this since the onset of highly pathogenic avian influenza. Why aren't we vaccinating for it? And it becomes a much more complicated question. It's not just a local concern, regional concern. It becomes an international concern. Our federal partners will always point to federal trading partners not being on board with vaccine and being concerned about how that works with trade implications. So that being said, I think we're getting some, we're loosening that up. So just the idea that the USDA is funding some research on vaccine is a huge step in the right direction. We also have to remember that this is an influenza virus and vaccines tend to be as good as the virus that you made the vaccine for. So it's not the magic bullet, I guess, is what I want to caution people. Certainly another tool that we're looking forward to having, hopefully in the near future, to give us a little more reprieve, a little reprieve to our producers as well. H5N1 in livestock. So I designate this differently. This is the virus that causes highly pathogenic avian influenza, but I refer to it as H5N1 in livestock just to distinguish the virus having an effect in other species too. So this was about 2 years ago that we first had the B3 3.13 that I talked about earlier, the dairy strain of this virus, a strange spillover that happened in dairy cattle in Texas, and then from there was shipped around the country, spread back to poultry. We had most of our cases in 2024 in poultry actually were that virus. We reported 10 cases in Minnesota in 2024. In 2025, the USDA implemented an order that we do testing of all dairy herds in the state to determine where this virus is, how this virus is affecting the states. We partnered with our friends at the Department of Ag, who was already doing testing in dairy cattle and milk, to further test for highly pathogenic avian influenza in the form of H5N1 in livestock. We had one case, a very interesting case that showed up. It was actually a repeat case. So by that I mean it was a case from a farm that had tested positive the year before and continued to test positive, very slightly positive. We did a lot of research on this, a lot of testing, finally identified one individual cow that was actually contributing to a positive tank in, or a positive test in the bulk tank. That cow was sent to Ames, Iowa for more research from the USDA, and we eliminated H5N1 in dairy cattle in Minnesota after that. So we were able to declare Minnesota free of H5N1 in August, so 4 months after that cow left. Interesting case, probably a case related to just an immunocompromised condition in that particular cow, but we are still at that zero detections as of today in dairy cattle. We've actually switched our protocol, or will be switching our protocol, from individual bulk tank sampling to milk silo testing. So a step back in our testing procedures, but still adequate to test the amount in the area.
Dr. Ace, I just have a quick question on the disease in dairy cattle. I was at an ag conference a couple months ago and got talking to a lady, and she's a Minnesota native, and she is the state veterinarian in Colorado. And they have had a high outbreak of the disease in dairy cattle, as has, I think, California and Nevada for a couple others. Why does it hit some states harder than others? And Minnesota has been really relatively free of the disease in dairy cattle.
Mr. Chair, Chair Anderson, yes, Dr. Baldwin is a Minnesota native, and the distinction is probably in how their dairy industries are set up. So there are very intense dairy industries in Colorado and California. Huge farms, tens of thousands of individuals on a farm, and in a very, very small geographic area. So the circulation of that virus is easier in that situation versus Minnesota, where we've got dairy farms across the state and varying sizes. There's also a lot more movement of dairy cattle in those states because of the size of those farms. So a lot of the heifer rearing, the calf rearing has to be done out of state, which means those calves and cattle are moving back and forth a little bit more. Avian metapneumovirus. I want to touch on this one as well. So another virus that's affecting our poultry industry. Some reports suggest that this has probably been as devastating, if not more, to the economics of our poultry industry, just because it is not considered a federally reportable disease, so it does not come with federal support in the form of indemnity. The producers are somewhat left on their own to deal with this virus. The virus also has a lot of similarities to highly pathogenic avian influenza, so we are doing a lot of testing for highly pathogenic avian influenza that ends up being AMPV. We did make some headway on this one. So Minnesota is overrepresented. Again, we're the largest turkey producing state in the country. So it's logical that we're going to have more cases of this. But it seems to be less of a concern nationwide just because of that. So we did have to do some legwork to try to get some more tools available to our producers to combat this. So there was a vaccine for AMPV. It was for a different strain of AMPV and not a very good vaccine for the current circulating strain. So we had to work with our federal partners, FDA, USDA, to see if we could get some additional vaccine imported. So vaccine we knew was effective that is available in Europe, live vaccine, which tends to be more effective on viruses. And slow but sure, we did get that approved, and we have live vaccine now available. So that has had a positive effect on taking care of some of the cases, but there's limitations there again as well. Vaccines aren't 100%, and the vaccine requires boosters, and boostering 30,000, 35,000 birds is not always an easy situation. So it's been effective. It's helped somewhat, but we still are dealing with two viruses in the poultry industry. New World screwworm. So you're going to hear me talk about New World screwworm probably more than high path in the coming years. I talked about this last year, just the idea that this had moved from South America and Central America into North America, into the southern part of Mexico. And unfortunately, that parasite is continuing to march slowly northward. So the closest case was actually within about 70 75 miles of the Texas border. That was due to an animal that had been smuggled from South America into a feedlot up that way. They were able to detect it, treat it, and eliminate any further spread of the parasite. Unfortunately, we're seeing more of a resident population. So Tamaulipas, Mexico is another state that borders Texas, and that's where we're seeing a lot of cases that are in animals that have not moved. So the indication is that means the parasite is established in that region of Mexico. The fly is circulating and life cycle is complete. So we're getting infections in all species. So cattle, we're seeing it in neonates, especially navel. Navels are an opportune place for these flies to lay eggs and for the larva to spread. But horses, dogs, pigs, little of everything is coming down with infestation, even people in these regions. There was some suggestion that the cold weather that we had earlier, those storms that ran through the southern part of the U.S., probably helped to keep that at bay, and I would agree, but spring is coming, and we're seeing the parasite move northward. The governor for Texas has actually already declared a state of emergency in preparation for New World screwworm making it into the U.S. There are some efforts in place, so they've shifted some of the sterile fly release. So one of our main ways of dealing with this particular fly is releasing sterile male flies. The flies mate once, and then if they mate with a sterile male, they release sterile eggs and can't continue the life cycle. So that's one of the main ways that we combat this. We're also seeing some efforts by FDA to give us more pharmaceuticals to treat these with. So there are common dewormers and antiparasitics that are used in livestock that were not labeled for use on New World screwworm. It would require an extra label arrangement, which means the veterinarian and the producer have to have kind of a relationship to be able to prescribe that in that fashion. That comes with a lot of consequences, a lot of questions as far as withdrawal times. Since then, the FDA has fast-tracked some emergency labeling for common antiparasitics for livestock species. So just recently, ivermectin injectable was on that list. But we have some other poron types of antiparasiticides that we use already that will be effective against the bug. The concern that we have here in Minnesota, in addition to livestock, so certainly livestock that are infected in our southern states would affect us. But we have a concern about the companion animals and pets that are traveling back and forth to countries that are infected with this parasite. So we're actually applying. There's another grand challenge for New World screwworm, and we are applying for some funding to research what surveillance is being done with travelers to these areas. So both travelers on their own, but also travelers with their pets. There's a large number of individuals that are traveling, vacationing with their pets, as well as those animals that are getting rides up to the United States with rescue groups. So we're seeing a lot of animals that are getting brought to the U.S. as part of relocation rescue to give them better homes. As I mentioned, one of the biggest concerns in these Mexican states for transmitting this parasite are the variety of species, including dogs. So feral dogs are a big problem in Mexico, and those are the same feral dogs that are getting rescued and brought to the U.S. So more to come on that. The USDA has also established a new area, including the U.S., southern border of Texas, where they're releasing these sterile flies. So being able to get ahead of the fly migration is kind of the intent of that one. But more to come on New World screwworm. My anticipation is we will see this parasite in the U.S. by this summer.
Just a kind of a follow-up on that. So let's say a Minnesotan brings a dog or a cat to southern Mexico, goes through the airport at MSP. What's the protocol now? I mean, would there be any method of detection? Is there any testing if that gets brought in? We have a lot of people take trips.
Yeah, Chair Hansen, that's exactly our concern. So there's protocols supposedly in place, but that's what our proposal for this grant is. Can we identify that they're actually being done? And part of the problem is some of these animals are getting transported into another state. So it wouldn't be unusual for like a rescue to bring animals into Texas. So we're not getting those import documents. The certificates of veterinary inspection would go to Texas, but those animals might go then from Texas to Minnesota or other states. But with regards to the individuals traveling, they're supposed to be inspected prior to returning. There's provisions that within 5 days of returning to the U.S., a veterinarian in Mexico is supposed to evaluate the pet to ensure that it is free from the parasite. Additionally, when they land at customs, there should be another checkpoint there where they're evaluating the animals and the people, too, for that matter, to determine if they've been in an area where exposure is possible.
Mr. Chair, so are our companion animal veterinarians and our medical folks receiving updates on identification or diagnosis? You know, I think both people and the veterinary, I mean, this is a new pest. So how do you identify? What's the training we're providing? What's the outreach?
Yes, Chair Hansen. Excellent question. We've been working with our partners at Department of Health to get the word out. So we are working on the veterinary side, getting information to our veterinarians through the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association to be able to identify cases that are worth considering. This could be a parasite that's infesting the animal. So certainly those individuals that are traveling, they have to get a certificate of veterinary inspection prior to leaving. So opportune time for the veterinarian to have that discussion with the owner about the possible parasites as well as other diseases they might be exposed to, and to ensure that they are rechecked upon arrival. And our friends at the Department of Health are doing similar things with outreach to caregivers on the human side, making sure that they're identifying individuals that are traveling to areas at high risk. Another part of our grant proposal is also identifying some of the migrant workers that might be coming from those areas and entering livestock facilities, just making sure they're aware of the concern about this parasite and that it potentially could be hitching a ride even with them.
Dr. Hayes, we've got about 10 minutes left for your presentation. Very interesting. I have one quick follow-up. Can this parasite be carried by migratory waterfowl?
Chair Anderson, I wish you hadn't asked that, but yes, someone else asked me that and it kept me up all night. So possibly. So the parasite is, it will infect any warm-blooded species, so that includes birds, and we certainly have seen cases of birds being infected in Mexico. I reached out to Dr. Carol Cardona at the University of Minnesota because she's a resident expert in poultry and poultry migration and some of these parasites and viruses that travel with them. She has assured me that it's not a likely route, it's not a direct route probably that we need to worry about here in Minnesota, but I'm still nervous about it. You have to consider if this parasite gets into an animal, it does not take long to devastate the animal. So especially a bird, we're talking about maggots that hatch and are pretty hungry within 3 days. And if that would infect a migratory bird, I don't think they would make it this far north. The problem being they could be seeding the parasite down along the way. So would they come here directly? I don't think directly on a migratory bird, but there's potential that over time we see down, you know, states moving northward until it could arrive. Fortunately, cold weather will knock it back, but we start all over again when the weather warms up.
Okay, thank you. Continue on.
All right. A couple of viruses that we dealt with this year. West Nile virus is something we deal with every year. Just wanted to bring it to your attention. Another one of those situations we work in partnership with our friends at the Department of Health. West Nile virus is spread by mosquitoes. We don't necessarily expect it's going to spread from animals to people, but horses are one of the animals that we see West Nile virus in late summer. The reason we are concerned about the human component is obviously horses have to be taken care of. So if there are mosquitoes in the area infecting horses, the Department of Health likes to know so they can reach out to the owners and caregivers to give them some protocols and things to do to eliminate the amount of mosquitoes in the area and prevent them from getting the same virus. Equine herpes myeloencephalopathy is big term for a virus that's actually pretty common in horses. It's we call it rhino. It's usually an upper respiratory virus, but for some reason the virus has decided to take a neurologic strain in some cases. So we see neurologic cases in horses occasionally throughout the year. We had 3 cases confirmed in Minnesota last year, just something that we like to know about so we can quarantine and prevent spread to other horses. There was also an outbreak in November of this past fall of horses at a rodeo event. So we're talking end of the year, big finals kinds of events. And lo and behold, they had this virus detected and the state vet sent everyone home. He thought it was probably safer for these horses not to be in the environment where the virus was, so scattered them to the wind, so to speak. So of those horses, 26 arrived back in Minnesota. Happy to report none of those horses had any signs of the virus. We did not have any detections in Minnesota. Other states, however, did. It was a little bit dicey for a few months. Some updates on our companion animal programs and diseases. A figure there, we've got a little over 15,000 dogs that were imported into Minnesota last year. I point that out for a couple of reasons. I talked about New World screwworm, but there's other diseases that we get a little bit worried about moving into Minnesota from other areas. Brucellosis is one that is high on our concern list. So brucellosis is a disease that passes between people and animals. In dogs, it's considered a lifetime infection. The result is you either quarantine your dog for life or euthanize the dog because it's a disease that we just can't get rid of. It's not treatable. So these cases have 100% been from animals that are imported into the state. We don't have a resident population of any creature that has brucellosis in Minnesota right now, and we are trying to prevent that. Tularemia is another disease I talked about last year. We had a record year for that again. 33 cases in cats this year, and I think the Department of Health reported over 50 in humans. Again, this is a bacteria that's spread by rabbits, and of these 33 cases, I believe 30 of them are from the metro area. So it's a very urban concern that we have with that one. 36 positive rabies cases were investigated in 2025. So 32 bats, 2 skunks, and 2 cats tested positive. Non-emergency priorities. So these are things that we are working on. They aren't here. African swine fever continues to be a concern of ours. We work with the DNR, actually, on their Squeal on Pigs website. So that's a place where you can find contact information. If you see a loose pig, you can call the number and they will contact the DNR, and the DNR will work with us to figure out if the pig is owned by someone and how to get it back home or how to dispatch the animal. Foot and mouth disease we do not have in the United States, but it's something that's been popping up in Europe. It gets concerning when our Western partners have diseases of this concern. We were fortunate enough to be selected as a state to participate in an exercise for vaccine distribution, which is going to happen later this summer. So it's a full-blown exercise where placebo vaccine will be distributed, shipped up to Minnesota. We will work with the University of Minnesota and Department of Ag, as well as some producers, to actually take this placebo out to a farm, inject it, and just observe kind of the process and see if we've got the right protocols and procedures in place to manage that disease. Kennels, we deal with some limits in our scope of authority with kennels. So we're the Board of Animal Health. We deal with animal disease and import regulations, but we are limited on our ability to work on animal welfare. That being said, we do work with our partner agencies. We've had at least a dozen cases this year of animal welfare concerns that we were able to either proactively be a part of or indirectly be a part of, working with some of the humane societies and humane staff to investigate what does fall within our purview and what doesn't. And then with our non-white-tailed deer farm, fencing and CWD research are the two priorities that we are dealing with there. So ensuring that our producers have their double fencing in place, and then we actually received a cooperative agreement grant from the USDA to work on CWD research related to genetics in non-whitetail deer or non-whitetail cervids.
Can you wrap it up in a couple minutes?
I can.
Thanks.
Going electric, we're getting into the future here. So we've moved to electronic certificates of veterinary inspection. As of January 1st, all exports have to be done electronically. And by June, we are requiring all imports to be done electronically. This just streamlines our staff's ability to process these certificates and helps us with traceability in animals that might have disease. In addition to that, radio frequency ID, RFID tags, are now required for most classes of cattle, which allows us, again, to scan and track those movements a lot more efficiently. Holding our bearings, real quick, this is just a nod to what Commissioner Peterson mentioned. We also were affected by that funding freeze that came earlier this month. Approximately a third of our, between a quarter and a third of our funding comes from cooperative agreement funds through the USDA. So Commissioner Peterson, I think he mentioned he had a rough night. I had a rough week. It took us a week to get that reversed. So that funding was brought back. Our funding comes in the form of reimbursements quarterly. So we report what we've been doing for the quarter and the USDA then refunds at that point. So we weren't in any dire straits at the time, but it was concerning what was going to happen. Just a quick point, there was no issue with the indemnity paid to producers. That's strictly between the USDA and producers, so that was not affected. And then my last point there is the board is apolitical, and this kind of goes to that. Funding should not be based on political leanings. The diseases do not know a political leaning. We just need to be able to rely on our funding and resources to be able to tackle the diseases that come before us.
Thanks, Dr. Hayes. Any questions? Quickly. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for being here. And just a question around the federal funding. So I remember earlier this month I met with MMB around just federal funding freeze in general, and they mentioned that of the funding to the USDA to Minnesota, one of the particular one that was frozen at that time was the funding for the avian flu. And so can you confirm, have that been unfrozen, or is that status still frozen, or what is the status of that?
Dr. Hayes.
Here, Representative Lee, that I think the funding that was frozen was through the diagnostic lab, through the university for the testing that has been reinstated. We do get some funding that goes towards testing and surveillance as well, and ours has been reinstated as well.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you, Dr. Hayes. No questions.
I want to go back to the vaccine question and the mRNA, and you were kind of talking about the challenges for approval and if the you have differing views in federal agencies on working on vaccines. Is there a role for the state to be doing research on mRNA vaccines, whether it's for avian influenza or any of these? I mean, if we have the ability to do vaccines and we can't, or it's not coming from the federal government, or if they don't approve it, can we do the research and do things at the state level?
Chair Hansen, I think any research we can do is more information for us. So I would say yes. Yes, if we can do research, doesn't mean the vaccine will get approved by the USDA, but until we research it, until we develop it, we don't know the effectiveness of it. So I think research is always a positive thing.
And a follow-up, and I'll go quickly, Mr. Chair. You know, if we go back several years, the question about an in-field test for CWD, we were waiting for approval from the federal government, and that was right around the corner. And the years have rolled by, and, you know, we still haven't seen that. And it's kind of the same question, that if the federal government has different priorities than approving technology that we've done the research for and that we've been able to show through replicated science that it works, what's the risk? I mean, what's the risk of us approving that if the federal government refuses to, whether it's a vaccine or whether it's a test that we've validated?
Chair Hansen, good question. I think the risk comes, it's not within our borders, it's outside of our borders. So the testing, if we recognize it within the state, it's not going to be recognized in other states, which would prevent that to be utilized for animal movements. It might infringe on trade, too, especially when we start talking about vaccines and different types of vaccines that international trading partners are not in favor of or not comfortable with. So it gets complicated beyond just our borders, right? There's a lot we can do within Minnesota, but then it's how do we still maintain commerce outside of our borders?
Thanks, Dr. Hayes. And last up, AURI, come on up, Shannon Schlecht and Mr. Sparks.
And as you're getting ready, we will finish at 2:45. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
Immediately.
Or 2:46, depending on how many questions we have. So. Representative Burkle looks like he's got a question. I don't know. He's smiling. Welcome to the committee, and if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Hansen and Chair Anderson. For the record, my name is Dan Sparks, Director of Government and Industry Relations at AURI. It's nice to see you all. Welcome back. We're very happy to be here today to present before the first Agriculture Committee hearing of 2026. We certainly want to thank you for your support for AURI. We appreciate that very much, and it allows us to do the important work that we do to add value to agricultural products and promote economic development in the state of Minnesota and the region. And I think if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, to be very respectful of the committee's time, I'm very fortunate to be joined by the chairman of our board of directors, as well as our executive director today. And I think if it's okay, I will turn it over to our board chair, Federico, to introduce himself, and we'll begin the presentation.
Proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, Chair Anderson, committee members. My name is Federico Tripodi, Chair of the Board of Directors of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. Thanks for allowing us to present on our results of 2025 today. At AURI, our mission is to catalyze the expansion of the agricultural economy, supporting jobs, creation, capital investment, and increased product sales. We do this by empowering new and expanded uses and markets of agriculturally derived products. About 4 years ago, we set in a new vision to become an economic catalyst for agricultural economy in the state. I am pleased to share today that we are well underway on our goal to generate $500 million in economic activity in our state by the end of this year. We are a 501c3 organization governed by a board of directors. I am privileged to join other directors that represent a wide range of our cultural ecosystem, including the Minnesota House and Senate, Crop and Beef Research and Promotion Councils, Minnesota Farm Bureau, Minnesota Farmers Union, agribusinesses, and at-large seats. Our approach as a board is to focus the organization on delivering increased positive impact towards our vision and mission, while being good stewards of our funds received and fostering an environment of strong governance. I would like to thank Chair Hansen for his service at the board of AURI, and welcome Chair Anderson to our board. I would also like to thank Representative Bank for her past service at our board. Today, I want to welcome a new member of our board, Brian Hansen, who recently joined as a director in an at-large seat after a competitive external search process. Brian brings decades of executive experience in food, nutrition, and ingredient sectors, and is a new addition to our board. AURI is spread across our state. We have laboratories and offices in Marshall, Minnesota. We have our recently opened Waseca Bioindustrial Center, and we also have operations and offices in Crookston and the metro area. Most importantly, we have over 30 employees that are widely distributed across the state. And a lot of our presentation today would be focused on sharing the results and the outcomes of the contributions the legislator has done to AURI this year, I'll open up at a high level, but the impact of our activities comes mainly from three areas of work that we have at AURI. First are initiatives that span a wide range of focus areas with renewable natural gas, hemp, and co-manufacturing of food products as just an example of them. These initiatives have a lot of indirect impacts in our state. We've been working on how to quantify those, and you'll see an estimate of $800 million of economic indirect impacts that are present and future from this activity. The second project type of activity we have is client projects, and this is kind of the most exciting, but we cannot share all of them. The client projects are from clients across the state, and we help companies, again, create capital investment, jobs, sales. We estimate that this year alone, there have been $189 million of new sales generated from this work stream in our state. And one metric that I like to always think about and that we talk a lot about at the board is when we look at the legislator investment in Minnesota, just in this work stream, for every dollar invested by the legislator, we get about a 40-to-1 return as a return on investment from this activity working with client projects and Minnesota-based companies. The third of our activities is conducting bespoke events that are related to specific focus areas. And here we can connect growers, industry, and stakeholders with opportunities and activate innovation and investment in the ecosystem and in our space. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and if it's okay, pass the presentation to our executive director, who can share more about how we have impacted the agricultural economy this year.
Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shannon Schleck, I'm the executive director at AURI, and it's a pleasure to be here with you and to share a little bit of our activities over the past year. I'm going to start we have two big buckets of what I would call them, and it's the work that we're doing in collaboration with many others and the work that we're doing on our own as well. Food is just it's an area that we spend a lot of time in. We have a dedicated team on food. Last year, we did about 100 projects in the food area, and these are pretty wide-ranging in terms of the work that we do, looking at food ingredients, as well as how do we help scale businesses and help businesses get started and get into different channels and different opportunities as well. So we provide a lot of informational resources to them in terms of how do you get moving forward, what do you need to know. We have an exciting area. We launched a virtual assistant, so using AI and putting in information that we trust and that's trusted and validated by our team, so that 24/7 access for food entrepreneurs that work maybe a couple of jobs, and when they have time, they can access and find out, get their questions answered in a very quick and efficient way. We have one-point lessons on key gaps and needs that we hear from the food entrepreneurial community. And then we have a virtual office hours as well that we've launched where we can just we make staff available to have those conversations, help point people in the right direction, and see how we can help move their journey forward. A big area of work that we've been looking at is scale-up manufacturing. This is a challenge not just in Minnesota but across the country in terms of how do you move from a commercial kitchen to co-manufacturing at an industrial scale. And the assets, it's a hard business model to figure out. And we've been working with a lot of different organizations to see how can we make Minnesota a destination for this scale-up manufacturing, this regional type approach of working with our food ingredient and CPG companies as well. We've had a great partnership with the MDA on the Regional Food Systems Infrastructure Grant, right, and looking at how can we provide technical assistance for that middle of the supply chain work that's needed to do aggregation, distribution, manufacturing, and processing. And then we spent a lot of time still on local and regional meat processing. And I think we have a large number of local and regional meat processors within the state. How can we provide new tools to them, new information that doesn't exist today? And one area that we've been working on is a benchmarking study that's done in other industries, right, for these companies to put in their information on operations and finance and compare against their peers and hopefully learn, right, a few new ideas in terms of how can they have a more resilient business as they look forward. And then our client projects are everywhere from product development, so working on what are different ingredient opportunities that that could be incorporated? How does that impact the product quality, the taste, the sensory, the texture? Right to nutrition panels of meeting those regulatory requirements. And then one area, too, that we spend time on is helping companies get into school lunch programs and just the validation that needs to happen there for them to enter some of our local markets as well. As we look at our bioindustrials, this is really a focus on non-food applications. Three areas that we've been focusing on over the last year are biogas or renewable natural gas, co-product valorization, so those byproduct streams, and then biomaterials and biochemicals. So what are different bio-based products that we can advance as we try to move forward, the use of our feedstocks and our rich agricultural crops that we have here within the state. So biogas is an interesting area. We've talked a lot about ethanol, sustainable aviation fuel, renewable diesel, but biogas is kind of an overlooked opportunity area that we've uncovered and that we think has potential here. As we look at our agricultural feedstocks that exist, we look at our agricultural industry of livestock and crop production, Minnesota has the potential to meet 13% of its natural gas needs through biogas of looking at our feedstocks. So that's a pretty large number when we think about additional value and economics. Today we have fewer than 20 anaerobic digesters on site on farms, but as you heard the commissioner earlier, we have over 64,000 farms within the state, and how can we look at new models and new opportunities to look at that renewable energy opportunity as well. We launched and released a farmer guide. We were hearing from producers that they were being approached by developers. We wanted to make sure that they had the right information to think about the different business models that they could look at. How does it work for them? How can they have that informed conversation as they're having those conversations with developers? And we're currently assembling an industry group, looking at what does a roadmap look like for advancing this industry within the state. What are needs, what are gaps, and how can we help move this forward to be beneficial? And how does that align with the Natural Gas Innovation Act that was passed previously, enacted within the state? Co-products, we look at everything from fuel, feed, fertilizer, just what are different valorization opportunities for those secondary streams that are coming off of processing. So we do a lot of pelleting work, a lot of densification work, a lot of dewatering, looking at drying. What are going to be the economics to make that pencil and make that work and add another dollar rate stream or business revenue to those processing companies to be viable and move forward? We've continued to have a lot of one of our early client activities was Sweet Scoop, which used wheat. As a base, is produced in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. We continue to look at new formulations for litters that are based out of agricultural feedstocks versus clay. Really interesting space in terms of how we can utilize our crops or byproduct streams in there as well. And then bio-based industrial hemp is an area that we continue to see interest around, looking at green building projects and some of the, movement that we're seeing here. The need for national standards around industrial hemp to advance that market opportunity, and we're having conversations with USDA on what that could look like as well. And then one company that I find interesting is Evolve out of Red Wing, where they've created a tapeless drywall tape using industrial hemp. So a savings in time as we look at home construction and utilizing, agricultural feedstocks there. And then we've had a great partnership with Minnesota Soybean in terms of looking at different products. There's from anything from rejuvenants for asphalt to looking at soybean meal-based fertilizers for higher value crop opportunities like horticultural markets, ornamentals, and things like that. So looking at a lot of different opportunities in that bioindustrial space. When we look at our work across the state, Federico mentioned that we have 30 staff scattered around the state. Our projects as well are really, broad-based. I'd say today probably 60 to 70% of our work is in rural Minnesota, 30 to 40% is in the urban area. All right, so we cover a lot of territory, and just a map over the last 10 years of where we've conducted our projects, just for clients, right? Because we look at our initiatives as statewide. And then as we look at our financial report, thank you for the partnership in ARI to move these value-added ideas forward. You provide our base funding of moving this forward, roughly 4.34 last year that you provided out of a total budget of about $6.5 million. And we're leveraging those dollars with federal grants, with partnerships, with fee-for-service work, with project fees, collaborations that we're doing with research and promotion councils and others. So looking at ways that we can leverage those dollars and really continue to advance these new opportunities with different partners across the agricultural value chain. And then our expenses, you can see there as well, where we're spending our spending those funds in our functional areas of work to advance our mission. Just a couple of testimonials that we have here. One is from an anaerobic digestion company that we've been working with, looking at the characterization work we're doing to look at biogas potential from different feedstocks, what that could look like for the swine industry here within the state, right, in terms of new innovations and opportunities there. Another with a food client that we assisted with in getting the nutrition facts panels, right, their product into the retail market. Another food company that we mentioned in our annual report is Mr. Momo. They are graduates from Southwest Minnesota State University. They have a dumpling company that they do via food truck, and we also help them get into the school lunch program. Just a great story of somebody that came here, went to school, left, and came back, and is now part of our food industry and sector here. I do have a video, Mr. Chair, but maybe I'll say that till the end if we have time to share a few testimonials as well. Just looking forward, some of the work that we're doing as an organization, one is around protein sustainability. I think we all hear protein, and fiber, right, in terms of a part of our diet. We are collaborating with the EMBOLD Coalition on looking at ways to advance protein sustainability. ARI is co-leading that work with that entity, and then we are also co-leading the animal feed or traditional protein work there as well to see what can we do in addition to soybeans, corn, right? What are other crops and how do those work into animal feed rations and how do we help catalyze those opportunities to make sure that there's pull opportunities and market opportunities for producers to look at those different crops. Hemp fiber research that I mentioned previously, the cottage food support, I mentioned some of the tools that we're providing there. I don't recall the numbers off the top of my head, but I think in 2015 it was around 500 cottage food licenses. I think today we're over 14,000. Or somewhere in that neighborhood. So just a lot of demand and that's needed for assistance in terms of helping our cottage food industry and our small food businesses. And then I've already mentioned our renewable natural gas and anaerobic digestion work. Just a little bit on biofuels, some of the areas that we're trying to move forward as well. We have a partnership with the Department of Agriculture on nutrient recovery. So looking at phosphorus removal at ethanol facilities that we could look at another value stream, right, kind of right size that into animal feed rations. We're looking at value added for DDGs, whether that be new ingredients, looking at that for food and in terms of the protein that exists there as well, and what food categories could that fit into. Looking at ethanol as a hydrogen carrier, as we hear about the hydrogen economy, ethanol actually has a very has a lot of hydrogen molecules in it overall. So it's a really good carrier for hydrogen that you can convert on site for meeting hydrogen needs for SAF production or other opportunities there as well. Carbon dioxide, looking at how could that play into the local fertilizer industry for creating urea through green ammonia, looking at it for different chemicals that could be done as well, or methanol, different e-fuels. And then ethanol to chemicals, right? We think of ethanol mainly for biofuels. But that's kind of how the petroleum industry started out as well, right, as a fuel. But they produce a lot of different products from those biorefinery operations. And what are some, you know, areas that we could start looking forward on for renewable chemicals that we could produce here as well. And then we hosted a renewable energy roundtable over a year ago looking at what are efficiency improvements for our ethanol industry to help lower their carbon footprint and just different technologies that they could employ as well to meet some of the policy incentives that exist for SAF and other credits there. And then finally, I'll just hit on, again, our economic impact. We couldn't do this without you and without many of our collaborators across the agricultural industry. This is really exciting as we think about the impact that we're seeing in terms of new values, utilizing our crops, right, expanding market opportunities through those new sales, de-risking ideas and processes to help that capital investment go forward. And then what I'm excited about is that $604 million at the top as well in terms of what companies are thinking forward around in terms of new investment in Minnesota that would expand our value-added agricultural opportunities here. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop there for questions. And if there's time, we do have a video to add as well.
We've got 7 minutes for questions. So any questions? Representative Abadji.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and thank you to the board here that's here today. One question, especially when it comes to kind of the cottage industries with your food producers, have you been seeing any impact from some of the federal, either federal grants being taken away or the federal incursion on some of those businesses? Have they been able to get off the ground, or the ones who have gotten off the ground, have they seen any impact from what we've seen for the past 2 months?
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Agbaje. Sorry,
Agbaje.
So our team continues to have conversations. We haven't noticed anything directly that has come back through our channels. Overall, I think it's been more secondhand in terms of concerns and challenges that they've had. In terms of moving their businesses forward. I think in terms of there's always a capital need in grants. I think as we look at our work as well, we've put in requests for grants, and they have been processed and reimbursed at the federal level, and that's mainly for us that we've been using to help the local and regional meat processing businesses across the state. I'll follow up with additional information, though, to you.
Any other questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here. And so as we look at the map of where you serve, and I think in one of your open remarks you said about 30-40% of that's in the metro area. And so can you tell us what is the strategic plan of your organization to really reach out to our urban suburban core to really impact, you know, our constituency who may be doing some of this work? You know, when I look at the map, I think I saw my district, you know, there's zero project, and then Representative Baja next to me may have like 5 to 10 projects. And so I want to understand, what are you doing strategically to help my constituencies out?
Director or Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, that's a great question. So we are involved in a lot of different organizations and collaborations to help spread the word around the work that we do. We're involved with groups like Naturally Minnesota, right, at close collaboration with the Department of Agriculture. We're attending different events and trade shows where we think there will be food businesses and those that would be represented, for example, like the Feast program that occurs, where there's a lot of food entrepreneurs. And then a lot of word of mouth occurs for us. I think we can always do better in terms of direct advertising or making sure that we're being present where we need to be present. And I would enjoy a conversation, a follow-up in terms of ideas that you have in terms of events or locations in your district where we could have a greater presence and make sure we're having those conversations.
Any other questions? I have two quick questions, and this will kind of foreshadow a couple of bills coming forward, but could you maybe highlight the legal expenses and not in great detail, but and then also your budget reserves, the trend line on budget reserves?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, for legal expenses, we've had a trademark issue that we've been dealing with as an organization. There's a food company using AURI as their brand. Overall, it's created a lot of confusion in terms of misdirected communication to us as an organization that we've been working to resolve and working through the Patent and Trademark Office on that issue. So we've had some additional expenses there as we try to move that issue to a resolution that would be not damaging to our brand that we've worked over 35 years to build up as an organization. So that is an ongoing expense that we've had here for the last couple of years that was unexpected. The second question that you had was around our reserves. So we have a board policy of targeted reserves around 9 months. Our reserves have been pretty stable and steady over the last several years in terms of what that dollar value is. So today it's right around $5 million that we keep as a reserve. And that is really beneficial for us in terms of we work on a reimbursement basis on a lot of our projects and grants as well. In terms of having that liquidity to move forward and for unexpected expenses that may arise. And we look at that on a two-year budget cycle with the state in terms of how we look at that. So we're under a 0.5 ratio, in terms of where our reserves would stand.
I think we have about 3 minutes for a video.
Okay. This is a fun opportunity. So we have seven collaborators here I will start it here, and hopefully we can hear it.
We are an innovation-focused organization that works hand-in-hand with producers, with businesses, entrepreneurs, and innovators to take their ideas and move them forward to the commercial market.
So I put together a concept, put together research, put together ideas.
I think that's not coming through on the other one, is it?
No. Can't see it.
Let me see.
Yes. Put it all into a Ziploc bag and got a hold of AURI, made an appointment, and sat down with the researchers in the Waseca office and said, this is what I want to do. I want to create a high-value horse feed that addresses a lot of their nutrition issues or all of their nutrition issues without causing chronic health problems.
An idea comes in, AURI is kind of the hub of the wheel, and they see somebody else that might be able to utilize that idea or push it down the road. And so that's, you know, that information exchange and that being that hub.
At Step One Foods, we see agriculture as the solution to our healthcare problems. AURI can be central to this effort. In our state, we have kind of the perfect scenario, right? We have agriculture that is strong as a foundation of our economy. We have med tech that in some sense is a world leader, and we have world-class medical care. Bring all of those together and we can be the Silicon Valley of food as medicine.
The word that best describes AURI is collaborative. They bring different minds in, different expertise. They pull from industries across the state, across the region, not just Minnesota, but across the region, for us to leverage.
So AURI has been the start of unlocking innovation to small companies that are up and coming, to large companies that need a different avenue. They're always looking for that new way to help that business succeed.
We work with businesses to help commercialize new ideas that create demand and utilization of the crops that we produce. Typically a couple hundred million dollars in new sales every year that we help drive.
Not only are they able to do that same propulsion with different businesses of adding value, but also they're at the forefront of looking for that needle in the haystack, that new product that no one's even thought of yet.
What AURI can provide to other businesses, I think, is not well enough understood. They can provide such a wide range of expertise in areas that many businesses wouldn't know that they have. Other companies could certainly benefit from people that are willing to sit down and understand where you're trying to take your business, what are the hurdles.
So one of our primary focuses here at AURI is helping companies and entrepreneurs add value to co-products. The big question that always comes up is, what is a co-product? And one of the examples that I have is, take oats, for instance. When we grow oats, that oat, before it can be used in a pet food diet or even a human diet, has an outer covering or a shell, the oat hull, on it. That oat hull needs to be removed off of the grain, and then the oat hull is a co-product. And what we'll do is help identify uses for that oat hull, such as bedding material. It could be used for a biomass fuel and so much more.
At Redhead Creamery, AURI has helped propel our products forward and figure out our processes faster. In the grand scheme of things, we're a quite small company, but it's added value to us. It's helped us grow our amount of commodity milk from 0% to about 15% value added, and we're on pace for 50% in the next few years.
That meeting was life-changing. That meeting was the impetus for me to grow Stable Feed and to create these wonderful...
We'll stop there. Yeah.
Thanks. We get in trouble if we go over. So.
Right. Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, AURI, and thank you, members, for being with us a couple of minutes late. The next meeting, February 23rd, we hopefully will have bills on the agenda. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.